Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Hi, I'm Robert Petkoff, and you're listening to the greatest discovery on Maximum Fun.
Captain!
Captain!
Captain. Signatures detected!
Shields up!
Signatures detected!
Red alert!
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Coming up a little later in the show, we've got a great interview for you with Robert Petkoff, the reader of Star Trek : Picard : The Dark Veil. But first, we always love to open the show with what we like to call a Marin Open.
I feel like we're both really up in our heads about sounding professional, using correct pronunciations on
yes,
our
we're,
words.
We're up in our heads about using correct pronunciations, Adam.
It was so much fun to do the interview and also like realize utterly what a non-audio professional I am. How terrible an instrument this voice is in serving me in this way.
We'll get to that in a little bit, but we're also going to like recap the book to whatever extent we can. This was a fun one. It's another one of those books that is, I guess, set like before the events of season one of the show. So
of the Picard show.
Right. So it's not connective tissue between seasons one and two. And I haven't heard any news about season two. I mean, I know that it's a go, but it doesn't sound like they're filming it right now.
Yeah, I don't know if they're in production at this point.
Yeah, it could be a long wait for that season. I was just thinking the other day about how Peace Stew is like, I mean, he's an old man and there was some talk of it being like hard for him as an old to like do a full production day in the way that, you know,
pipes only go so far, right?
I mean, he did seven years of TNG and those sets, like they're like, when you hear people talk about like what it was like to shoot on TNG and Deep Space Nine and stuff, like they worked long days. And
well, Patrick Stewart campaigned hard to become a Gollum because he knew that the Gollums needed like a 18-hour rest cycle, like as things. So a lot of what he does on the show, I think, is just going to be him plugged into some chair and charging.
Yeah. How many seasons do you think we get of that show?
I think one of the like inspiring takeaways from Picard and its production was like how energized Patrick Stewart was about doing it.
Yeah.
And I think his comments about the project went something like, I'll do it as long as it's still fun. So I hope that means we get several more seasons. And I hope the show doesn't end because of his inability to do it anymore. Versus a choice, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if they'll do it like Curb Your Enthusiasm, where like if he has an idea for a season,
They put the band back together.
The Patak Chicken episode is going to be a real barn burner on the next season of Picard.
This is great. This is a great place for warriors to bring women that they are cheating on their wives with, because their wives will never come here.
I think what we should do...
Okay. Pitch me.
Like, do a brief recap of the novel... And then go to our interview with Robert Petcoff, who read the audiobook of it.
Uh-huh.
Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, and then we'll be back after the interview to wrap up the show.
I love it.
That sounds like a format we can stick to.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and talk about Star Trek Picard, The Dark Veil by James Swallow. An author name we will not be making fun of for the entire episode.
Picard is not the main character of this novel, which surprised me. Like, it's Troy and Riker on the cover, but I thought with Picard being in the title that he would make more than brief kind of cameo-like appearances.
Yeah, you're right, Ben. Like, you get inferences about Picard's character. You get a little bit of him at the end in the form of, like, a kind of button on the book.
Yeah, and he shows up like at maybe like the 1/3 mark for like Riker blowing in a call to be like, hey, I'm in a bit of a scrape with some ROMs. Can you give me a little bit of advice, captain to captain?
And you get so much setup for that moment because like we're in mid-scrape, in media scrape with Riker. And then we cut to France and it's like, is Picard going to be into using these drones to water his plants? Right. And Laris and Chabon are there. And I'm like, oh, cool. We're going to get like a whole storyline woven through here where we get more Laris and Chabon.
Another opportunity for Picard to like get the cavalry mounted up and ride out. And Laris and Chabon are going to be part of it.
Yeah. We need our Laris and Chabon book, like just about them.
Yeah, I mean, Chabon doesn't need to show up for that necessarily.
If Laris needs to be driven somewhere or like supported in any other way.
Or needs like a neck rub or something.
Right. I mean, there's Chabon. Yeah. Perfect for that. But like, let's go on Adventures with Laris.
Adventures with Laris is a series of audiobooks that I would be delighted to listen to.
It's a comic book series that writes itself.
It sure is. So the way this book opens is Riker showing up in kind of like Romulan court. And I'm very much picturing Romulans in place of Klingons in the Undiscovered Country court. Like,
me too.
The description of the space sounds so much like Undiscovered Country.
Yeah.
And the book is very like, I think it's a little jokier than the previous Star Trek Picard book we read.
Got that feeling too.
A lot more like nerdy, like references to other sci-fi things. I caught like, I mean, there's a point where Laris quotes Dune and quotes specifically the character that Patrick Stewart played in the movie Dune.
Mood's a thing for cattle and love play.
That part stuck out to me too, and it reminded me of like a version of the Infinite Monkey at Infinite Typewriters situation. Like if you're writing novels that feature Patrick Stewart and you have an infinite amount of novels to write, you're eventually going to include that line of dialogue.
I know.
Said at him, though, interestingly, instead of by him.
Right. So at some point, the tactical officer on the USS Titan says,
3 marks at 210.
An X-Wing line from Star Wars, the movie.
Right.
There's a bunch of things like that. But anyways, we cut back in time after it starts to look like this trial is not going well for Riker. And we cut back in time to like the events leading up to him being on trial.
You're probably wondering how I got myself here. Says Will Riker.
So gather round while I break it down.
Yeah.
And the USS Titan is on a classic Star Trek Uber mission where they are delivering some diplomats to a planet. This is a planet that is kind of like on the edge of Federation space, abutting the neutral zone. And it's a species that is not member species of the Federation, but are like kind of like lightly allied with the Federation and not allied with the Romulans.
Yeah, not only not allied, but they were like, thanks, but no thanks to Federation membership. And everyone is incredulous about this. Like, who wouldn't want to be in the Federation? These people are fools.
Yeah, we'll give you holodecks. We'll give you replicators. We'll give you so many great things. We just want to be friends.
And that's part of the mystery. Like, the mystery is twofold. One, they don't want to be in our space club, which is too bad. And two, how did they fuck up their planet like this? Like, they've scooped out everything of value from their planet, and they've made this giant generation ship out of the pieces.
Yeah. And they're also like super secretive. Like, there is a member of Riker's crew that is a Jazari. That's the name of this species. And like, he can't be transported. He can't be scanned. It's like against their custom to permit any like penetrative scanning.
Do you think Spermbot was the first draft name of this alien, and then they just decided Jazari could probably sneak that one by?
The Jazari are an incredibly secretive people, and this drop-off mission quickly turns into also the Jazari member of Riker's crew is submitting his formal resignation, and they announce, like, all Jazari everywhere are leaving the Alpha Quadrant and going as far from you freaks as possible. And like, this is like such a slap in the face to the Federation, who are like, all we have ever done is try to be friends with you. What the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. And not a low ranking crew person on the Titan either. Like a bridge crew person just like takes off the badge. He's out.
Takes off the badge. He kills one guy with a batleth and then he leaves.
Yeah.
There was one part of this book that I felt like was never quite wrapped up, which is that like early on they have like a scan of this Romulan warbird that's like just on the other side of the neutral zone, and they're like, it's fucking crazy. This ship isn't even cloaked. It's absolutely bananas that we picked them up on sensors. And that must mean they're up to something. It must mean they were doing this on purpose. They wanted us to know that they're there.
Yeah.
This is like an intentionally, you know, provocative move on the part of this Romulan warbird. And I don't feel like that's ever resolved, like why the warbird was so down to just be like, hey guys, I'm over here, just FYI.
It felt like it was a part of Medica's quality as a captain, as a Romulan, as a person. Like, Medica from jump seems like someone who's not into the veil. As a thing that's applied throughout the book to different people and situations, he's out there. He's hanging it out there for everyone to see. Like, one of the main frictions in the story is between Medica and Helic.
His Tal Shiar, like, dog walker / first officer. Like, she is there to keep an eye on him, but also to take orders from him. And there's like so much conflict in that arrangement.
This is like getting pipped, right? Like, if you're a captain and you're assigned a Tal Shiar first officer, that's an improvement plan from management. Like, you fucked up.
Yeah. And like, this is taking place like in between the attack on Mars and the supernova. So it's like a couple of years of the Romulans being kind of left high and dry by the suddenly skittish Federation and feeling a lot of like super legitimate grievance with the Federation over like pulling back on this offered help. And I thought like one of my favorite things about the book was how much it put me in the mindset of the Romulans over mm-hmm. and over again, like making me empathize with how wronged they felt at like they were suspicious of the offer of help, but then like the help being withdrawn only confirmed that suspicion.
Yeah.
And like that, like, I'm not that suspicious of a person. Many people would describe me as naive or or even foolish, but but like I felt like,
was I supposed to argue against that description? I just wanted to be sure what my role was there.
more so than the television show or the previous novel, I felt like I was like getting into the mindset of the Roms, because there are lots of scenes where you're just on the Arthrus, the Romulan warbird, with Romulans talking to each other. And some of them are like Medica is a little bit more open to the idea of the Federation, and Helic and other people she talks to are a little bit more closed off to it. Mm-hmm. But you really get the sense of like what they thought about the whole thing.
I really agree with you. Like in the Picard season, we saw like Romulans on the edge of town acting like assholes toward Picard, and you're made to take Picard's side because something about that behavior feels unjust because it's attacking a favorite character. But you spend so much time in this book with that side, you're really made to, it's very persuasive about their distrust in a way that I was surprised by. It was effective.
So there is this space disaster where the like the last few things that the Jazari are doing are like breaking down their starships, and I guess they like came flat pack from Starship IKEA, and now they're kind of trying to like disassemble them and put them up in their generation ship so that they can make their long voyage across the galaxy.
Planetary production's over. They're pulling up their tape and their cables and getting the hell out.
And they're like breaking down this ship with one of these like huge deconstruction platforms, and like the warp core or similar goes haywire and creates like a singularity. And there's this like space disaster where if the Titan doesn't like get in there and try and close this hole that's opening up in space time, it's going to swallow up the entire star system and then maybe like keep growing. Like in the Star Trek universe, it's possible to fuck up in a way that like eats the universe accidentally. And so like the Titan isn't strong enough to plug the hole by itself. It is no Dutch boy.
It feels like space deep water horizon. Like that's the thing they're trying to solve for. They need to junk shot this hole, don't they?
Yeah. And it takes the Arthrus, the Romulan warbird, showing up with an offer of help. And so what this does is like it fucks up the Titan and the warbird, and they now need the help of the Jazari, who don't want anything to do with any of them. But are like offering that help kind of begrudgingly, like, okay, well, you saved every member of our species, so I guess if you need to fix your ship, you can beam some of your people over here.
It's really awkward because the entire time the Jazari have a deal, they're like, you're not allowed to scan our ship, you're not allowed to beam over, you're not allowed to do a number of things that is revealed later to be technologies in place to obscure their true nature.
Right.
And this is part of the discomfort, is after the Romulan ship and the Titan are injured, like they were about to light out and leave, like they're just about to leave the party. And now they're like, oh, okay, I guess you need a ride.
I do have jumper cables in my trunk. I'll see what I could do to help.
And you can't say no because you have all these biospheres, like everything meant to support life and like to be a space life craft is right here. You'd be an asshole to say no.
You'd be an asshole to say no, but like one thing that comes out in some of these early discussions of, is the Titan crew going to go bivouac on the Jazari ship, is that like the Romulans are looking at this huge generation ship and going like, you could solve our problem.
Yeah, you got any more of those generation ships?
Yeah, like we need to move a few billion people from one place to another. Like if you guys could delay your trip for 5 years, like two years, like you could like literally save the Romulan Star Empire.
That's a big ask though, Ben. That is... That's really putting the Jazari into a bind.
It's a big ask, and it's also like the two most paranoid species in the Star Trek universe.
Right.
Like the Romulans being as ridiculously secretive as they are, and the Jazari being as ridiculously secretive as they are. And I felt like there was like less made of that of like how parallel their species are in some ways.
When you do a favor for the Romulans, I don't feel like you get to bank that as something coming back to you.
No. Could you do me a favor?
One other character that plays a pretty big role in this book is Thad Riker. Thaddeus Worf Troy Riker.
Did you think this was the story of his life and death? Because I was positive he was going to be they were going to find out about his disease. And at the end of the book, we were going to realize exactly how Troy and Riker took a break from their commission, went to that planet, built a log cabin, and started making pizzas.
I said out loud, I was walking the dog, I was listening to the last chapter in this book, and I said out loud, don't make me go through this, because I was so worried about what was going to happen to Thad at the end of this book.
Yeah.
And that is not what the book deals with.
I wonder to what extent the book knows our expectations surrounding Thad and wasn't playing us for that tension, because he spends a lot of time in a bio bed being scanned and put back together. And I was like, well, certainly the Jazari with all of their technology are going to get a hit off of the scan.
Right.
But that never happens.
They're either going to see that it's happening, or it's going to be somehow the fault of the scan, but they don't pick up on it immediately.
Yeah.
Anyways, the problem is that the Titan has been banged up so badly that like most of the ship is uninhabitable, and then energy that they need to fix the ship is in competition with the energy they need to like run life support. Mm-hmm. And so if the Jazari can kind of take, you know, a good portion of the crew off the table, like from an energetic standpoint, it'll speed up the repairs for the Titan. So they're like, well, like, this is great. We want to get underway. We are in fact on our way to the other side of the galaxy. But if you want to like fly alongside us, that would be great.
Can't really stop at this point.
Yeah. It's like doing the jumper cables while driving.
You've just come out of Ralph's with your grocery bags. You're like, look, I really don't have time for this.
There's a lot of mint chocolate chip in here. And if I don't get home pretty soon, it's going to be a big mess.
Yeah.
And then the Romulans come in with kind of a surprising offer of help of their own, which is like, hey, there's a big gnarly nebula that you need to fly through in order to like head in the most direct way toward your destination. We happen to have the only good star charts of that nebula. So we'll like lead the way. You guys can tag along, and we'll keep the two ships safe. It'll be like a gesture of amity between the Romulans and the Federation, and we'll get these Jazari out of here in one piece.
And Helic standing behind Medica, like her eyes have rolled backwards 10 times at this point. Like it's nothing but bridges too far between Medica and Helic. Like it's bridges as far as the eye can see that Medica's crossing. Because when he agrees to like grant star chart knowledge to people, I think that's really the beginning of the end in that relationship.
He is the Captain Ramius that doesn't plan to defect, right? He's got the political officer, and he if he'd only punched her ticket at the beginning of the book, like none of these problems would have happened.
Right. Medica's like, God, doesn't Helic ever take a break? Jesus. Go have lunch, Helic.
You're always weighing in on everything.
You are really crawling up my ass right now.
So among the federations that go live on the Jazari ship in what's called the Ochre Dome, which is the name of one of the like biospheres that I guess like the outside of the ship has a bunch of like biodomes, and they pick the one that doesn't have Pauly Shore in it to live on.
Who's the king?
Squirrel.
Who's the shrew?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind's eye, I saw like a long cylinder type shaped ship and then a bunch of like bubbles coming off of it.
And then like one little part at the back that's kind of shaped like a rabbit.
Yeah, one of the ends unscrews for the insertion of the power source.
Right. So Troy and Thaddeus are among the Federations that go down there, and they're like literally camping in tents inside this biosphere. And Thaddeus is a precocious kid who gets into all kinds of trouble and starts like sneaking around the ship, like finds a way to leave the dome. He makes friends with one of the sphere-shaped drones of the Jazari, which he's able to do because he can like quickly interpret languages, and this sphere is making like a light pattern. And Thad is able to kind of like, he's kind of like the universal translator embodied, I feel like.
I think the book does a good job in writing kids in that way where they're constantly doing stupid shit that you totally believe. Like,
yeah.
Like there's a group of kids and they're like teasing each other, and Thad wants to look brave and he can't get anyone to go with him on his mission. And so he goes on his own. Like,
yeah,
it totally pencils out.
He's a really good character. He's like, reading him in this book made me miss him in the show, you know?
Yeah. And throughout this story, there's never even a hint of, you know, Thad doubled over with a headache he couldn't explain. there's no Chekhov's headache about him throughout this entire story. He's just a regular kid. And what is he, six?
Yeah, he's six. I feel like he's maybe written a little older, but maybe that's because he's supposed to be like such a genius.
Right.
But anyways, like on one of his misadventures, he's like already gotten in trouble a bunch for sneaking off and like exploring on a ship of aliens that don't want to be explored.
I did not expect the Troy Riker household to be spankers, but there are like four or five pages that just describe the spanking that Thad gets in a lot of detail, like more detail given to the Thad spanking than with the eye trauma torture that Alec doles out at that Jazari.
And like the Vulcan chief medical officer catches Troy doing it and is like, what are you doing? And she says, well, if my mom raised me this way, then it's good enough for him. And he's like, that is such a terrible justification for like a completely backwards practice. What the fuck?
I mean, many other Star Trek books have taken a hardline stance on spanking your kids, but like few have gone as many pages as this one.
Yeah. Anyways, he is like sneaking off yet another time and manages to like bear witness to Helik with a couple of motorcycle bad guys like that are under her thumb, like clandestinely sneaking onto the ship and abducting a Jazari. And I loved this too, because like we learned so much about the Jat Vash in Star Trek Picard, the show, but mm-hmm. I always wondered, cause it's supposed to be it's only women in the Jat Vash, but they do have aligned males. And I wondered like how they recruited, how they cultivated those relationships, and the dudes that Helik can like rely on to be like blindly loyal to the Empire that populate Medica's ship are interesting characters. And she's able to like go abduct this Jazari. And then there's this like totally nasty torture scene where she's like cutting him up while he's still alive and interrogating him about what the Jazari are up to.
There's so much more torture than I expected for a book that spent as many pages on young Thad Riker and his storyline. I really got the bends in terms of tone.
Yeah. My wife and I started watching Baywatch, which it's on Hulu now, and I've never seen it, and we've only watched two episodes, but it's like, it's such a like 10 out of 10 horny show.
Yeah.
But also David Hasselhoff's like young son is like a storyline that keeps happening, and I'm like, why the 8-year-old in the like ultra horny show? Like, maybe leave the 8-year-old out of it.
Well, like that Hasselhoff is so virile. Like, the show is so horny, and also, look at what he can make.
One of the ROMs is this science guy. I forget his name, but he's...
We're talking about Vadril, the conscience of the group.
Yeah, Vadril is like... It is heavily implied that it's kind of his fault that the Romulan supernova is happening. And I thought that was really interesting because that was such a big mystery that was left dangling.
Can you imagine having his Twitter account? Like, fuck. Yeah. Everyone telling him what a piece of shit he is.
Yeah. I logged on one morning and I saw hashtag Vadril is over party. And I was like, what's this all about?
I like his utility as a counterbalance to Helic, though. Like, there's that tension. Like, Helic has tension with Vadril as much as she's got tension with Medica, you know?
Yeah.
How much, like, here's an aside that's still related to this, but, like, Helic has seen into the well and has, like, seen the hellscape that comes from synthetics taking over and genociding all of other life. How much, and like, you understand Helic's motivations after having seen that?
She's scared, but she's also slightly deranged. Like,
right. But the people who work in Helic's periphery have only been told of such a thing.
Right. Like,
obliquely about why she's so...
Many of them haven't even been told. It's just that because
that's
of her position
saying.
In the Tal Shiar, meaning she is like closer to the Praetor's.
It's a
will.
Really interesting tension when you think about like her motivations versus everyone else's, like second or third hand motivations.
Yeah. So when they abducted this Jazari guy, they left a bomb back on the Jazari ship to like explode and make it look like an EPS conduit blew out. And that's why this guy is missing, because he got vaporized by some accident on the Jazari ship that was not caused by Romulans. And Thad gets caught in the explosion. So hence all of the medical tent hangs for Thaddeus. And it's like, it's bad enough that it's like, It's not looking good for Thad until the Jazari kind of make an offer of help that nobody can refuse. They're like,
right,
this is literally his one chance, and it might not work, but it might.
Concurrently, tensions escalate between the Romulans and Riker on the Titan to the extent that that Helic has taken command of her ship, and along with a couple of other Romulan ships, attack the already crippled Titan, and there's a fun dogfight scene.
Yeah.
In it. I think the action sequences in the book are pretty well conceived.
Yeah, they're really exciting. I feel like reading about a space battle is a really different experience than watching one on television, and like hearing how all the like mechanics of it work in the book was really fun and good, and it's bracing. Like, you're worried for the generation ship, you're worried for the Titan. Like, it's definitely borrowing a lot of tropes from like Wrath of Khan, where they're in a nebula and the ships are super fucked up, and it's like a they live fight.
Put on the glasses.
It just keeps going and going, and they keep getting worse and worse off.
Helic gets very General Chang after taking command of her ship, like very monologuing to no one, very inner monologuing to herself in a way that's very arch. Like they really lean into those tones here.
She's not a seasoned space battler. Like, she doesn't have the reps, and they're... are some Romulans on the bridge of the Arthrus that are like loyal to Medica that are like, well, she's the new captain and we got to do her orders, but I'm not going to not say that this is a terrible idea.
That's what Riker's counting on. Riker even says in the book, you're not a captain until you shoot 10,000 torpedoes. Everyone knows that.
Yeah. And Riker kicks her ass like twice.
Yeah. Pretty fun.
Outfoxing a Romulan has got to be like the funnest shit. Like when she holograms into his office and thinks she's loaded a virus onto his computer, and he's like, no, I have in fact loaded a virus onto your computer.
That was the scene that I was going to bring up, which was like, God, don't be just a... You're such a dope, Riker. Like, you're actually letting this happen. until it's revealed that this is all part of Riker's plan to begin with. Like, he's never not in control of a situation.
Yeah. Well, I think his biggest asset, low-key, are Keru, the tactical officer, and Christine Vale, his first officer, who is also, she came up through Starfleet security and really gave me Commander Shelby vibes. Like, I felt like she was very much based on Commander Shelby in both the fact that she's like ultra paranoid and always trying to think of like what the angle is that anybody is pursuing, but also the fact that she and Riker don't get along that well. Like, they don't always agree on stuff, and she will really, you know, make her displeasure heard if she doesn't feel like he is doing the right thing in a given moment.
I mean, I think if you're Riker, you're always going to be chasing that Shelby dragon, right? Like, Absolutely. If you can't put Shelby in as your XO, you're going to get a Vale. And Vale, as you're describing, like, is just as quippy. Like, anytime there's an opportunity to quip, it's the Vale character who does it in this book.
So they cripple the Romulan ship with this virus. They like beam.
She's one of the Dark Vales in the book, isn't she?
Oh, Christine Vale. I didn't even think about that. she is on the commando team that beams over to the Romulan ship, and like half of them go sabotage the warp reactor and half of them go free Medica, who is able to like unseat the coup that Helic has put in place. And then they have to go on trial. Like, these like old style warbirds come out of warp and are like, like, we can make this a problem for all of y'all if you want, but if you don't want that, you can come over here and be in this undiscovered country trial.
That was another Star Trek 6 tone. That was another rhyme that this one bit, which is like, when Kirk makes the decision to subject himself to trial, that decision happens almost instantaneously. Like, he beams off and he's there. And Riker does the same thing. He thinks about it for a moment and he's like, well, if it gets my crew off the hook, I'm beaming over. And then he's gone.
Yeah. And we like pick up, I guess, after him kind of relaying the story. And the thing that he leaves out, we have to kind of like mentally think back through the book and think of the parts that he told and the parts that he didn't tell, because the thing that he leaves out is that the Jazari are in fact a race of androids and are from the Andromeda galaxy and are going back home because of the synthetic ban in the Federation. They feel that their presence in the Milky Way galaxy is no longer viable because so many biological species are turning on androids. And that's why Helic, as a Jat Vash, was so convinced that she had to destroy all Jazari everywhere.
Like, I really felt for the Jazari because they were trying to leave a party without saying goodbye. And they just keep, and like, they've been spotted by the host and they just can't leave.
Yeah. It's the Jazari goodbye is the nightmare of all Irish people.
It's true.
And it doesn't come out in the trial. Like, nobody will say this out loud in this context. And Helic winds up paying full price for not succeeding. Like, the description of the Tal Shiar and the Jat Vash as being like incredibly results oriented organizations, I thought was so funny. Like, she did exactly what they wanted her to do, but she failed. So she doesn't earn any respect from them if she doesn't actually get the job done.
Right. Right. She really gets her pants pulled down in front of everyone. Huge bummer. Medica innocent, Helic guilty, Riker innocent, Spock present.
Yeah. It turned out Riker had a lawyer there the entire time, and it was Spock. And
when the lawyer assigned to you is Spock, that's a pretty good sign. That's a well-funded county, I think.
Totally. Yeah. He talks about like stuff to do with reunification. He talks about stuff like he wants to like holler at Geordi to get some ideas about how to forestall the supernova, which, like, I did not expect this book to be tying a thread between reunification and Star Trek 2009, but it totally does.
Yeah. Pretty wild.
It was a good cameo.
His lawyer was described as having a sibilance, and you know where my head went. I was like, holy shit. How would you like Kevin Uxbridge as your lawyer?
As a man who has dedicated his life to stopping the destruction of all blanks everywhere, in general.
I'd like to see you find my client guilty without any gavels.
I have to apologize to the defendant's wife, who has a deafening ice cream truck playing in her head right now. That's just something that happens when I come around her. My sincere apologies, Mrs. Troy Riker.
Yeah, speaking of Mrs. Troy Riker, button on the book is a Beta Z bun in the oven.
So much happier of an ending than I was expecting, because like that part of the book starts with like, yeah, well, we're gonna have to do a lot more scanning, Thad, to make sure that you're,
yeah,
you know. And he's like talking about like the imaginary planet that he's drawing maps for, like we can go live on an island together, and I'm like, oh god, this is about to be such a gut punch.
Yeah, like all he wants to do the entire book is have a permanent home and not live on the ship, and in my mind I was like, well, sorry kid, your life is going to be nothing but pain and disappointment.
The only thing more permanent than home is death.
a pretty rip-roaring tale, quite a bit longer, I think, than the previous Star Trek Picard book we read. I think that one was maybe 8 hours and this was 12.
Wow. I really felt it, because that first book I listened to on a road trip driving from Seattle to LA, that was the move yeah, week. And I took that down easily on that drive. And over the last couple of weeks, it was really like 2 hours here, 2 hours there to knock this thing down. It was a bigger effort for sure.
Yeah. I also think did it on a long road trip. I think I like went up to the Bay Area to see my mom and dad, and I like listened to the first half of the book on the way up and the second half on the way back down. And this time, yeah, it was like walking the dog, doing the dishes, like just finding little moments to listen to the audiobook. And I guess like I really liked it. Like I was like, if I could count on myself not to drift off and lose my place in the book, like I could see like listening to an audiobook being a great way to go to sleep. And I'm sure that there's like a technological solution to that that I could just find out about. But yeah, like it's really nice. And I think that like the thing that is nicest about it is how well read it is. And should we just get right into our interview with Robert Petkoff?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Robert Petkoff was kind enough to join us for an interview. And I mean, his was the voice we heard in our heads for so long. I think we finally got him back.
Yeah.
Putting ours into his.
So here is that interview.
One of the most fun multi-hyphenate combinations I think that you can get is star of stage, screen, and headphones. This show is beneath him, clearly. But we are so psyched to have Robert Petkoff on The Greatest Discovery. Welcome, Robert.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I feel elevated.
We've listened to two of your audiobooks now for the show, and we've really enjoyed the heck out of them. So I'm a little starstruck because you've played almost every character I love from Star Trek.
It's like the best part of the job. I mean, the first one I think I ever did was an original series, and that was what I grew up watching the reruns of. And so when they were like, well, you're going to do, yeah, we don't want you to do exactly try to be Kirk or Spock, but just give us a feeling of them. And I was like, wait, what? Do I have to pay you guys?
That's so cool.
A long time ago, they were done by the original cast. They used to do them as a multicast. And so it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice that they don't do them anymore, that I get to.
Does that quality cut both ways, though? Because like, on some audiobooks, some fiction audiobooks anyway, I can imagine like these aren't characters we've seen on TV before, but with Star Trek, we kind of know how they look and sound. And so there's like an existing voice format for them. Is that something that is a greater challenge for that reason?
It is. I mean, listen, I never try to like mimic because I'm not that good. I'm not like that at all. But I do try to give a quality of it. And yeah, it, you know, thank God Karen Perlman is the one who produces all these books with me. And she's fantastic about looking up who's in memory alpha, who's memory beta, you know, because if they're memory alpha, we got to search them down and we got to hear what they sound like. You know, I think we did one character once, and then midway through the book, I'm like, this person sounds familiar. We should look it up. And we, sure enough, and you know, I might have been doing a voice like this. And then you listen to the actor and the actor's like, where were you from? I'm like, oh, nuts. Now we got to go back and start again.
You're not doing like Kevin Pollak doing an impression of, but you're also not like embodying the character with some of the essence. Like, I think, I mean, this most recent book, like your Riker doesn't sound like you're trying to do Riker, but it also sounds like Riker to me.
Right.
Jonathan Frakes has a force when he speaks. You know, he's just very, very direct, you know, and so you just sort of pick up that quality. You know, Captain Picard, we've got it, blah, blah, blah. It's that sort of emphatic sort of speaking that's fantastic. But I wish I could Kevin Pollak it. I mean, I think the books would be amazing. People would be like, wait, William Shatner sounds so young. You know, it would be amazing if I could do it. But just giving a flavor of it is fun. And I know we did an audiobook where it was a young Kirk, very young Kirk. So it was thrilling to try to do like a 10 or 13 year old William Shatner.
Wow.
So you're just doing a voice, but occasionally you pop a word, you know, and you try to do just a flavor of it. It's really fun.
That's awesome. I was walking my dog the other day listening to this audiobook, and you've got the bridge of the Titan, you've got the bridge of the Arthras, the Romulan ship, and all of the cast of characters on both bridges. You've got all of these aliens on this other ship. You've got like brief interludes on Earth. And I was like, my mind was racing. Like, how does he keep all of the characters straight? Like, when I read a novel, like I'm like, which is this guy? Have we met this guy before? Or is this guy from like 10 chapters ago?
That guy.
And you're remembering who those guys are and also how they sound. And that's like so mind-boggling to me. And it really like helps me as a listener keep the thread straight. And I wonder how much goes into crafting that.
I made the mistake once early in my narration career where I was doing a series of 20 books and I got kind of behind on prep. So I thought, you know what, I'll just cold read this next one. And we got a character in chapter 2 that came back in chapter 17. I mean, he'd been speaking for a while, you know, multiple chapters. But in chapter 17, our author generously said, he said in his light German accent, and I was like, you son of a, why would you not even share that with your readers from the get-go so they can have that in their head? So I literally had to go back and find every instance of him talking. Since then, I make sure that I read every book in advance, fiction books. And then I go through, I have an app called iAnnotate. Shout out to iAnnotate on my iPad. It's really great. And
Rob,
I
beep that out. We can't advertise
that. You can't have that, no. I use an app called what's so great about it is I can highlight dialogue. So what I do is I pick a color for each character, you know, like Kirk would get a yellow, Spock would get a blue, McCoy would get a darker blue. I'm a little pedestrian that way. But we go through and I would highlight all the dialogue. So at least when I'm doing a scene in a chapter, I know, oh, I know who that character is. I can jump very quickly. But also the cheat is that Karen Perlman, our producer, has the engineer drop a slate or drop a mark at each new character so that on day 2 or day 3 of recording, when a character shows up, we go, wait, let me hear that one again. What did I do for that?
Right.
And so we can hear a quick clip and go, oh, yeah, he's got a huskier voice than I was just doing. But it ultimately makes it, like you said, it just makes it clearer, easier to follow when you're listening to the book. You go, oh, that's that person.
You have done a ton of television acting too. And I watched your reel before we started recording, and it's
like how it starts.
It's so fun. Yeah, it's.
I knew we'd like talking to you after you get kicked in the nuts by Mariska Hargitay. Yeah.
That was like one of my favorite things. And when I got to see it on TV, I was like, oh, this has got to be the start of my reel, me punching Mariska Hargitay. my favorite part of that was when we were on set doing it. After the first rehearsal of it, the sound guy came up and said, you don't need to make the punching sounds. We'll do that. And I'm like, oh, because I literally, when I swung my fist at her, I went, psh. And I'm like, oh, dude. And then the next take, he came up and I go, did I do it again? He goes, no. Mariska, you don't have to make the sound when you punch him. And she was doing it. And it was fabulous. We're both kids playing, you know?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That was a lot of fun to do.
I didn't see any Star Trek on that reel, but if you were, there's so much Star Trek in production now. If you could pick a one episode role, do you have a dream part for Star Trek?
Oh God, I would love to be in prosthetics so I could do a voice, you know, but no one necessarily has to see my face. But that would, I mean, to be on a Star Trek episode of anything, I would love to get onto that newest, Strange New Worlds?
Strange New Worlds, yeah.
Yeah. I would just kill to be on any Star Trek, you know. That would be a dream come true. And I did a thriller play years ago with Gates McFadden, where I was a psycho killer trying to kill her. And she ends up, you know, pushing me into a hot tub with an electric wire in it. And I got to, you know, go up. But it was great, you know, getting to work with Gates. But, you know, whatever. I envy, what's the actor who plays Saru?
Doug Jones.
Yes, I envy him so much. You know, that all the, because he gets to be a hundred different things and he gets to vocally play it, you know. And that's sort of what I do with the audiobooks. But it would be great to, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Great to do that on TV. Oh, I would kill to do that.
We've had a long-standing campaign to get blown out of an airlock on one of the new Star Trek shows. Yes. And if Strange New Worlds has an episode where they have an alien with a lot of prosthetics and two humans that get blown out of an airlock, this could be perfect for the three of us.
It's perfect. We'll be a new alien race that tries to take over the Enterprise.
Yeah, there you, blow us out of there you go.
Package deal only. If you want Robert Petkoff... We're coming with.
You unfortunately also have to have Ben and Adam.
You have to have Yeah. Have Ben and Adam. Sorry.
One trailer, these two guys stay outside.
You guys get the John.
Yeah. We just stand around the craft services table going like, hey, Anson, remember when you were on our podcast?
Yeah, Anson's a friend of the show. Yeah. He'd remember us. You know, they're making so many new Star Trek shows. Eventually, we'll all be on.
Yeah,
I would hope.
In the future, everyone has 15 minutes of Star Trek.
Yeah,
that's right. Oh, God, that would be a dream.
Ben and I, not professional voice actors, occasionally we will stumble over some words. And for me, it's one word every time. I can't say particularly without eating shit on it.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm wondering if there are any words for you that you see them coming up in your type and you're like, oh no, here it comes. I better stick the landing.
I mean, literally, particularly is one. I just did that really well just now, just to be impressive.
Awesome.
But if in the middle of reading, it'll be particularly. You're like, no, not particularly. You know, and I have I use a liquid U a lot of times, maybe too much, influenced by the whole Shakespeare and stuff like that. And so occasionally they're like,
I keep the liquid U in a nightstand.
That's right. That's right. But you gotta like sometimes tune that down. I did a thing called Putin's Kleptocracy, filled with Russian names. And more recently, I did something filled with Chinese names. And, you know, the listener never knows this because they're like, wow, that just rolled off his tongue. They don't hear the 17 takes I did trying to get that one name, you know, correct. And just dying laughing, especially because it becomes a mental, when you see the word, you're like, here it comes. I know I'm going to mess it up. And then you mess it up. I think the thing about narrating that has been the most eye-opening for me and the most humbling is how many words I have always pronounced incorrectly until you're in a studio and someone says, no, that's not it.
Sure.
Like, oh, yeah. I think that's it. I've always said it that way. And they're like, yes, well, you've always been wrong.
Having podcasts has really illuminated that for us too.
Right? I just found one on a book I was just doing. John, as I say, John Quincy Adams, like so many of us know, the town in Massachusetts for which he was named is Quincy.
Right.
And so it's John Quincy Adams.
I think Quincy is wrong on this one. I think it should be pronounced Quincy, and I think that there's more of us than there are of them, and we can right. we can overrule them.
Yeah. In the audiobook world, we always default to Merriam-Webster.
Speaking of pronunciation, there's a character in this book, Thaddeus, who is like multilingual and speaking a made-up language a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it struck me that like when you like break into Korean and then to French and then to Kalu for a second, like that's got to be its own kind of acrobatic
special
feat.
Hell. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's one of those things you're like, oh, God, you know, Karen Perlman really knows French well, so I can't get away with anything French that's just like a close to it. Uh-huh. She's like, no. You know, and so, you know, every one of those things, if it's Korean, anything like that, we have to go look it up. We have to try to find it. The author may not know sometimes. You have to find a source.
I think what you do is kind of a miracle because it's like I listen to the whole entire book and then that's the first time I hear music is at the very end for the credits. And I'm like, oh my God, I listened to 2 weeks of an audiobook without music or special effects. It just hung on one person's voice and their ability to do voice work. And I think that's like when you stepped up and did your first audiobook, did you feel that kind of pressure to entertain without everything that's on the periphery of doing television or theater? Like it's just you.
It is. It's weird. I mean, listen, for an actor, it's from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. Let me play the lion too. You know, bottom. I want to play every part. And so audiobooks is perfect for that because I finally get to do every part. And I think the very first audiobook I did was Lincoln, A Photo Biography. Odd title.
You just
for
described
an
the pictures.
Yeah, I was like, I did the dialogue. I did the narration in the book, but it was like, this doesn't seem to me like this
one
the most...
is also black and white.
Yeah, that's right.
Looks like he's wearing a hat.
Imagine if you will. But the second big book I did was called Beat the Reaper, and that was just like this guts ball. Josh Bazell wrote. It's a guy who is a hitman in the mob, but. But he's in witness protection. He's gone through medical school. He's now a doctor in a New York hospital. And on this day, he runs into someone from the old thing. And so he's got to decide, do I stay and save this patient? Do I run? And if I stay and save, I know that I'm running the clock out before the hitmen come. And it was just this very Quentin Tarantino kind of guts ball thing. I mean, listen, I don't want to spoil the ending, but there's a moment where he literally must take a bone out of his body to fashion it into a weapon. It was fabulous.
Right.
It was just that book, you know, but it was so much fun and it was first person. So it was very much just like acting. I just became the character and did the thing. And then and in the books after that, it was like, oh, okay, great. But it is, there is this sense that you don't want to drone on. You know, I joke about nonfiction books as I'm trying to talk to an attractive person at a party and tell them the story. But that sense of I need to try to keep the ball in the air. I need to keep your interest. And it's hard because, you know, cause on hour six of the third day, you might be a little tired, you know, and I do warn producers and engineers. I'm like, listen, if you start hearing me drone on or get pedantic, please let me know because I want to keep it like we're talking right now, you know, because it's much more interesting, you know, to talk about architecture or politics or whatever. If I'm talking like this, then if I were. And then John Bolton moved down. He opened the door and saw the file. And you're like, oh my God, I'm already asleep.
Right.
It's terrible. So you
try to keep like a 1.5 martini buzz going the entire
right.
3 days.
You know, that's how did you know my technique?
Hold on, I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. You want to keep the shaker out of the takes, you know,
yeah.
The clinking of the ice. But no, I mean, God, it's such a fun thing to do. And, you know, it can be very mentally taxing. Obviously you're doing all this focus for a long time, but at the end of the day, if I'm come home and I'm tired, my wife's like, oh, you must be exhausted. I'm like, yeah, but I wasn't laying bricks. I wasn't building a skyscraper. I wasn't cleaning toilets. I wasn't detasseling corn like I did as a high school student, you know, in Illinois. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. So this is a gift from God, you know, this is so great. You know, the only thing better than this would be getting to do a Star Trek episode right. or a series where I played a regular character in Star Trek. Anyone listening?
Anybody listening? We know that some people that work on Discovery listen to the program, so hopefully yeah. this does not fall on deaf ears. But Robert Petcalf, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much for coming on the program and talking to us, and thank you for all these great audiobooks. We've just had such a fun time listening to them.
Thank you. This has been a blast.
Thanks a ton, Robert. Appreciate it. Wow, so we really enjoyed our time with Robert Petcalf. As you can hear, the guy's just totally game. Really cool.
We talked to him for like three and a half hours, and we only put about half an hour into the episode. But he was a real fun hang. Yeah. Very generous of him to spend the time talking to us. And here's hoping for that Robert Petcalf team up where he and the two of us get to go on Strange New Worlds and get blown out an airlock.
Really excited for that day.
If he could be like the heavy alien, and we could be his detail, and we could all get blown out an airlock together.
I think that's how it should be. As I said, it's a package deal. You heard Robert agree to it also.
Yeah. I think that's definitive. Just reach out. I mean, I'm sure he has a talent agent's number on his website.
Just CC me and Ben on that.
Make sure you include us.
Before we wrap up the show, I know we have a couple of priority one messages here. Ben, you want to get to those?
Let's do some P1s.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Hey, we've got a couple of P1s here. This first one is of a promotional nature, Adam, and it goes like this. Do you like the introspection of Star Trek : Picard and the relationships between the crew of the Big D? The Titan Run trilogy has all this and more. Meet the crew of the mining ship Kraken, harvesting the lakes of Titan, and the crew of the non-Starfleet Phoenix as they learn what their fancy new ship can do. Though millions of kilometers apart, they are intertwined in a struggle for life, love, and redemption. Volume 1, Breaking Orbit, and Volume 2, Kraken and Phoenix, out in Kindle and paperback now. Volume 3, Statute of Expectations, later this year? Visit titanruntrilogy.space for trailers and links to Amazon. Wow, how awesome, given that the USS Titan is the main starship in this book that we just read, and we've got the Titan Run trilogy being advertised here on the program.
I love the author of these books not even including their name in this. Yeah, big fun over there in this Titan Run trilogy, again on the USS not Starfleet Phoenix. That's how you get around being sued by Paramount right there.
Yeah.
Ben, our second priority one message is from Amy K. It's to Molly and Jordan, and the message goes like this. This shout out goes to my friends and fellow FODs, Molly and Jordan. From that Halloween staff meeting where two red shirts had their first low-key nod of mutual Trekkie recognition to our weekly online game hangs during quarantine. Thanks for being great friendos. And for introducing me to the greatest Trek family. Love you guys.
Wow. Thank you, Molly and Jordan, for spreading the word. And thank you, Amy K, for getting a P1.
And thanks to the crew of the Titan Run trilogy for getting a promotional P1. Priority One messages, so important for supporting the production of the greatest discovery.
Yeah, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron to book yours today.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! You know, Larkins are a little bit different from Shimodas, but I gotta say, the person having the most fun this week was Robert Petkoff. Like, listening to him do that is so much fun, and it's clear that he really, like, enjoys the material.
Yeah.
And it's like watching like a really virtuosic musical performance, like hearing him like go through all the different characters, like he's having conversations. Like there'll be a McLaughlin group
issue one
in the book where three or four characters are having conversations and he's like remembering what the different voices are and like going back and forth from character to character. And it is just so fun to listen to. And it's, and I was both amazed and jealous, but also like a little bit like intimidated by how virtuosic it is. So he gets the Edward Larkin from me for this episode.
I really can't argue with that nomination. Solid Larkin this time, Ben. Occasionally when you interact with someone as talented as Robert is, like my expectation was like, God, he's so good at this, he's going to be a total snooze as a person. Like, because that's how virtuosic people often are. Like, everything is about the craft,
right?
And that craft is taken very seriously, and that is their life. And I mean, Robert Petkoff's craft is taken very seriously, but he's also a super fun hang.
Yeah.
And I love that it's possible to be that way and be as talented as people like him are. So
yeah,
just think that's very inspiring.
Neither of us will ever know what it's like to be super talented, but it, you know, it's a relief to see that it's possible to be still a super fun hang despite your talent. Well, Adam, let's leave it with Rob's from here.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica. The show is produced by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Make sure to go check out his YouTube page. He has some amazing recipes and is doing quite phenomenal work over there. You should know that Ben has a cameo on his channel this week. Hey, if you're looking for more Trek, why don't you discover some episodes in the old back catalog? I'm sure you'll find something you enjoy. You can also check out episodes of The Greatest Generation, or you can follow us on other places like Twitch, Instagram, and Twitter under the handles Greatest Trek. The socials are handled by the great Bill Tilly. Thank you, Bill. Keep being an awesome card daddy. Make sure to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or support us at MaximumFun.org/join. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of The Greatest Discovery.
Yeah, well, this is why I love Bones too. God bless it, Jim, I'm a doctor. Spock, what do you want me? You know, it's like, he's so much fun because he's so juicy to do.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.